Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the reviews are in for the new show at Northlight Theater in Skokie. The show, The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord, is a hit. Both the Sun-Times and the Tribune gave glowing reviews. It's a play that puts three of the best minds of all time together in a room debating religion and politics. What could be better? The play was written in 2014 by Scott Carter. Carter is a former stand-up comedian and actor who's performed everywhere from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival to the Aspen Comedy Fest. Carter is currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. He also was with Maher on Politically Incorrect, where Carter produced 1,100 episodes. Scott Carter is my guest tonight at the big table. Scott, welcome to the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here, and I love Chicago whenever I'm here, and it's just such a wonderful city.
Well, let's talk about the play. I mean, this is something that you've been working on for a long time.
I got the first seed of this in 1987 following a near-death asthma attack that I had that put me in the hospital for about a week, and when I came out of the hospital, I had this kind of epiphany about the urgency of dealing with the big questions of life. And I'd always kind of poo-pooed. I'd been indifferent or hostile to the notion of religion, and I wasn't raised in any kind of strict religious household. But I made this vow with the universe that for the next couple of years, at least, if anybody wanted to talk to me about religion, I would have to listen. So if I was walking down the street in New York, where I was a stand-up comic at the time, and somebody with a Mr. Microphone was haranguing a crowd, I couldn't keep walking. I would have to stop. And I would have to listen until I figured that I got the essence of what he was saying, he or she was saying. Then I could walk on. Or if somebody on the street was handing me a pamphlet, I would have to take it. I had a Jehovah's Witness come to my apartment every Wednesday at 1 o'clock for 2 years. And each Wednesday he would come in, I would put him on the sofa, give him a glass of water, he would talk to me for an hour, and at the end of the hour I would say, Kim, once again, I do not agree with anything you believe, and I will see you next week.
That has to be, that is wildly ambitious for religion to be able to be open for this, but it's also exhausting, the idea of listening to everybody pitch their certain specific religion.
Well, I had come so close to being dead that I thought I needed to be considering perhaps interpretations of life that perhaps before that time I had just disregarded. Now I had to at least consider them. And it led me to one of the things that happened at the time was Bill Moyers had this wonderful show called World of Ideas. And one day he was interviewing a fellow named Forrester Church, who was a Unitarian minister on Madison Avenue in New York. And he started talking about the Jefferson Bible. And Jefferson, one of the most incredible people who ever lived, at night, while living in the White House — he was the first president to live 8 years in the White House, although he called it the President's House. They didn't call it the White House then. He got two copies of the same edition of the Bible. And then he went through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four Gospels, with a razor. And he cut out all of the verses that he liked. And then he got a blank scrapbook. And with a pot of paste, he made the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four different stories. He made his little pieces into an original new gospel. And then when he retired, he left Washington in March of 1809 and went back to Monticello, never came back to Washington again. And in 1820, 6 years before he died at the age of 83 on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, the same day as John Adams. He made a more advanced copy of this, where he got two copies each in Greek, Latin, French, and English. And so if you read it across, you can see the same verse in four different languages, or you can read it down in any of the languages. Jefferson read six or seven different languages. And he kept this a secret from his family. Wow. So they only found out about it after he died. And then they kept it in their family until they had no money. 6 months after he dies, Monticello is sold. They finally sell to the Smithsonian this existing copy of the Jefferson Bible for $500 in 1898, then in 1902, there's a U.S. representative who passes a bill to print 9,000 photocopies of it and give them out to new senators and congressmen as they come to Washington. And so Forrester Church's father was Frank Church, senator from Idaho. Mm. He got a copy of the Jefferson Bible, brings it home, gives it to his son, and his son is so struck by it, he then becomes a minister. He goes to Harvard Divinity, becomes a Unitarian minister, which Unitarian was one of the sects that Jefferson was most compatible with because it was one of the least dogmatic. So anyway, so then I thought, well, there's some sort of play. There's something here. And I got a copy of the Jefferson Bible. And you're reading it. And what you see is you'll see like three verses from John and then two from Mark and then six from Luke. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something here. Maybe it's two one-act plays. And the first is Jefferson's dying and the nature of the American democracy and how that's going to live after he dies. And then maybe the second half is the story of Jesus. And it's kind of putting together, making a parallel. And there were three or four different ideas like that that I had that I worked for a long time on. Then in 1996, Politically Incorrect had moved to L.A. I was in my local bookstore and saw the spine of a book called The Life of Our Lord by Charles Dickens. And I'd never heard of this before. I thought I knew all the Dickens titles. So I get it down and then I open it up and I realize Dickens did the exact same thing that Jefferson did, except all of his choices were the exact opposite. Because Jefferson gets rid of all the miracles. And the miracles are what Dickens loves.
And you don't think of Thomas Jefferson or Dickens or Tolstoy, for that matter, in this kind of way where they're going to be that into, you know, recreating or reassembling the Bible. That's not something that necessarily you would think of those historical figures.
Well, Jefferson only let three or four of his best friends know about it because he was afraid that his political enemies would find out and make an allegation that he was not a Christian or make an allegation that he was not religious at all, which mm-hmm. had already come up when he had the letter to the Danbury priests about the separation of church and state. He was already the enemy
right.
of all of the clerics in the country.
So they wouldn't look too kindly to him doing an abridged version of the Bible.
No, and furthermore, he's opposed to them. I mean, there's a line in the play which is taken from Jefferson where he says, it's priests who are the real antichrists. Of these three volumes, Jefferson, Dickens, Tolstoy, none of them were published in that person's country in their own lifetime. So Jefferson kept it to himself. Dickens, when he died, he left a three-page will. One of the provisions in the will was that his Bible could not be published until the last of his children died. Well, he had 10 kids.
Wow. Is that so for protection?
So he dies in eight. Well, he did it for them. When the fifth was born, he did his own gospel, and he read it to them so often that all of them could recite it by memory before they had learned to read and write themselves. And he eventually had 10 kids. So the last of his kids did not die until 1933, 63 years after he died. And so it was published in 1934. And then Tolstoy, by the time he finished this, his Gospels in Brief, he couldn't publish anymore in Russia. So in those days, he would have to get one of his confederates to take manuscripts, take them to Switzerland or some other country where they'd be translated and published and then distributed out from there. So it's not like, I mean, Tolstoy was a proselytizer. He was evangelical for own eccentric notions. But Jefferson and Dickens would not necessarily have wanted you to know all about their religious feelings.
And that's the basis of the play,
yes.
Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord. It's them discussing together their versions and sort of picking each other's apart.
They are trapped in a sort of limbo where each thinks his path to salvation depends upon convincing the other two that they are wrong. So it's these three alpha males who are used to no one contradicting
them. I have so many questions about this. Okay. Scott Carter is the playwright. He's also currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Scott Carter. He's currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. He's got a show up at the Northlight Theater called The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord. It's running till June 12th. All right. To be able to get everyone's gospel together is one thing. How do you make that a play? How do you make that a transition for those kind of works and be able to transfer it to the stage?
If I were smarter, I might have figured out a way to do it quicker. But it's now 29 years since I got the first idea. on this. So I've done at least 100 drafts. I got the first draft was finished in 2005 of sort of the current version. And everybody hated it. My wife hated it. My lawyer hated it. My agent hated it. Everybody. So I just put it away. And then
they're like, stick to TV. Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're doing well.
You're doing well. What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. So, and I've been continuously working in TV since 1988. So there was a break in 2008. So I went back to the script. And because I'd let it gestate for 3 years, I now looked at it and saw, this belongs in the play and this doesn't. So I boiled what had been a 151, 10-point type kitchen sink of a play that was a mess. I agreed with all the people who detested it. I boiled it down to about 50 pages. And then I called Gary Shandling, who is a friend of mine. We grew up together in – we didn't grow up together, but we both grew up in Tucson. We went to the same high school. We became friends later on. But I called him up and said, I've got this thing I've been working on for so long. I've never told you about it. Can I come over to your house and just read it to you? And so he said, yeah, let's have dinner. So come on over. So what I did was I went over to his house. We have dinner on the dining room table. Then we move everything aside. Then I got three sticks. And I got pictures of Jefferson, Dickens, and Tolstoy and put them on the sticks and had a glass of water, had my script out in front of me, and then started reading. But I would hold up the stick for whoever was talking at the time so he would not be confused by my inability to do three different voices or do a Russian accent or an English accent.
That's where your accent. Performance background
yeah,
comes
yeah,
into play
yeah,
here.
Yeah, that's right. And we got about halfway through, and he said, let's just stop and talk about everything that I've heard so far. And then he gave me like 15 pages of notes. Mm. And then he looked at his watch and said, it's late. Why don't you come back tomorrow? So then I thought, like, I'm like Scheherazade. I'm coming back the next night. And I came back the next night. We finished it. And then I waited a week, looked at all of his notes, made a rewrite. And then the next house I went to was Norman Lear's. I did it at Arianna Huffington's house. I did it at Arianna Huffington's. It was at Christmas time. I didn't do it by myself. I had three actors reading the parts. And Shirley MacLaine was in the audience. And so afterwards, she said to me, we need to talk, and could we have lunch together? And I said, I would be delighted to have lunch with you, because that's one of the reasons one gets into show business is to
have
lunch,
right,
with Shirley MacLaine.
Sure.
So she sits down and she says, first of all, I want you to know that the reason that the Star of Bethlehem hovered in the sky was that it was not a star, it was a spaceship. And then she said, but the reason I want to talk to you is that I want you to add Sir Isaac Newton to the cast of three people. Isaac Newton is who my friend Stephen Hawking, I believe, is the reincarnation of. And then, you know, I said to her, look, I've been working on this for so long. And if I keep adding characters, it will never get
the
finished.
The blocking alone. I mean,
yeah,
you're going to do
yeah,
an extra character
yeah,
in this,
yeah,
right?
Well, and also then would be two English people. You know, I mean, it's kind of nice that I've got an American, I've got an Englishman, and I've got, you know, a Russian. And that kind of all works. The three that mm-hmm. we've got are perfect. And people will say to me, why'd you pick these three? No, they picked me because they all did the
right.
exact same task.
Exactly. I was going to say, I'm not sure if Newton did a
he didn't.
Yeah.
He did some. He, Mark Twain, a lot of different writers have done little parodies of parts of the but these are the only three I know who did exactly the same task.
Let me ask you, you know, I think of there's a lot of theater we'll see on stage that's impersonations. But the concept being that there seems to be a lot of historical performances, characters that are brought out. This is different in the way that, you know, you put a play together and these three are going off their own gospels. But talk about how it is different and it's, you know, how do you get away from the idea that somebody comes out and a Thomas Jefferson says, hello, oh, look at that cell phone. You know, like that kind of thing that seems to what we see over and over and over with historical fiction or historical characters on stage.
Well, the way you do it is you're raising the stakes for the three characters involved, so it's not some sort of languid lecture of people telling you how great they were. I mean, from the very first moment, these three are in direct opposition with each other and think that the future of the eternal fate of their souls hangs in the balance. And then at the beginning, you know, Jefferson lives first, so he's never heard of Dickens or Tolstoy. Dickens is next, so he's heard of Jefferson, but he doesn't know Tolstoy. Tolstoy does know the other two. But so for the first part, they're establishing each other to themselves, and they're figuring out because, I mean, for all three of them, for Jefferson and Tolstoy, they both lived on thousand-acre estates where they were the patriarch of everything they saw. And for Dickens, Dickens was used to not only being the prime novelist of his day, but also he gave over 300 public readings where he would get 1,000, 1,500 people listen to him, both in Great Britain and in America. He came here twice, listened to him read from his work. So he was really, Dickens was really the first celebrity writer before Oscar Wilde, before Mark Twain. In fact, Mark Twain's first date with the woman who became his wife was to hear Dickens's last American lecture in New York at Cooper Union.
I mean, for you with a background in stand-up comedy performance, I mean, you're working with Bill Maher, and there's got to be some interesting similarities on creating a play that has to do with three characters discussing something and what you've done in television for decades now. How much did you know going in about these characters, historical figures, Dickens, Tolstoy, Jefferson, and do you consider yourself a scholar on these after having to write a play for 29 years?
I would say that in the beginning, I knew very little, and most of what I thought I knew was wrong. And so there's just been this joy of discovery as I've been reading and traveling to different places and seeing things and talking to people. And then, I'm not a scholar, but I have benefited from a lot of writers, theologians, historians who've looked at the manuscript, who've come to readings, who've come to the play, who've given me pointers and helped me correct if anything. I mean, I want this to be within a fantastic setting. I want it to be absolutely as realistic as possible. And so that's why it's taken so many drafts. And that's why, I mean, there's a new great book out on Jefferson called The Most Blessed of Patriarchs by Annette Gordon Reed and Peter Onuf. And I'm reading it now and I'm thinking, I've got to do a little bit of rewriting. here's a good line of Jefferson's. Here's a better word than I've got. And let me shift that. So, for instance, he called Washington, D.C., he called it Washington City. He called the White House the President's House. And I'm thinking, that's just a couple lines. And then luckily, there's a published script now. But whenever they sell out a run, they told me, because I was very nervous about this, they said, well, when we do a second edition, you can make changes to the second edition. And that was like a blessing to me. That was bountiful news to me.
We're talking with Scott Carter here on Download the Show. The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy. Discord is at the Northlight Theater in Skokie till June 12th. We'll continue our conversation with Scott when we return after the news. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, Scott Carter. He's the executive producer of Real Time with Bill Maher, and he's got a show on at the Northlight Theater in Skokie, The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy. Discord. It's a hit, too. The Sun-Times and Tribune both loved it. The reviews are in. It's on stage until June 12th. And it really is tremendous. I mean, the amount of just you telling us in this first half of this interview about all of the things that you discovered and all of the research that went into this, this is much less than of a play and more of a like your thesis. like this is your life's work. This is
but I hope audiences perceive it as an entertaining. I mean, I've been delighted by the reviews talking about how funny it is and how entertaining it is, because the last thing I want is for people to think that if they pay for a ticket, they're going to be submitting to a lecture.
Right.
And that it's going to feel like a dusty museum piece, and that I want it to be vibrant like a play by Tom Stoppard or one of the current English playwrights or someone like George Bernard Shaw or Oscar Wilde, who I'm a big fan of the English tradition of plays of ideas, and we don't have that as much in America, but that's what this play is coming out of.
Well, I mean, you could – obviously your work in television – and you mentioned even earlier with Gary Shandling and the ability to have friends in Hollywood to be able to look at it, you're going to be able to create a show that moves, an entertaining show that moves. I mean, well, you're not going to be someone who doesn't have – you're not working in a bubble. You have so many people around you.
Well, a lot of what I do on Real Time is I'm the one that coalesces all the guests and gets them ready. I'm sort of a court-appointed lawyer to each of them in the final hours before the live taping. And so I'm orchestrating both conflict every night, but also the illumination of an idea and differing viewpoints to approach that idea. And so a lot of that came in really handy in this. And then also a lot of the people who appear on our show regularly, have become friends, and a lot of them have come to see it in L.A. or different – or it was just in Washington, and I hope friends are going to come and see it in Chicago. But I'll give you an example. The late Christopher Hitchens, who taught a course in Jefferson and wrote a book, a very good small book on Jefferson called Thomas Jefferson, the Author of America. I was telling him about this, and he knew about the Jefferson Bible, didn't know about Dickens, didn't know about Tolstoy. So every time I saw him, he would be on the show twice a year. We would talk about the play. And there's a speech at the very end that Dickens has on slavery. And it comes from Christopher Hitchens pointing me to a very not well-known Dickens book called American Notes. After he came to America the first time, he did an essay. And his last chapter in the book is called Slavery. And a lot of the points that Dickens in the play makes come out of that. Mm. So I wouldn't have that speech if it weren't for Christopher Hitchens.
Well, there's something about real time and politically incorrect before that, that being able to bring together the viewpoints, you know, varied and with variety so that it's balanced is one thing. But there's another to do it with authenticity, to do it where it's not staged, where people feel, oh, okay, this is going to be, you know. And you said it before, we've kind of gone away from, on the stage, these ideas, these plays of ideas. But I would say in television as well, where, you know, you think back to Gore Vidal and you think back to some of the stuff that we were doing in television in the late 60s and 70s, where it was about the idea and putting it on. And the only thing I can think about that still does that is Real Time. That's the only show where people come on and they have real, authentic conversation. How much of that is part of what you have to do to get these people ready so they're not staged, they're not going back to their bullet points or their, you know, what they decided to bring in before the conversation started?
My main job in that respect is to get them relaxed enough to be actually listening to what the other people are saying, so that their next comment is not some pre-planned comment, mm-hmm. but a real response that carries the volley of ideas on. And then over a period of time, I mean, we now have a lot of people we know are always going to be good in our show. And then each week out of the five guests, we're generally testing one or two, mm-hmm. see if they're people we want to have come back. But it's one of the delights, and I feel like I am so privileged that each week, I mean, no matter what Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday are like around the office, Friday is always a delight, and then we have a little party, and then everyone goes, I mean, you know, one time we had Pat Buchanan's sister, Bay Buchanan, was on the show, and I said, now, Bay, after the show's over, we're going to have a little party, and we hope that you and your friends who are here will come to it. And she said, you're kidding. And I said, no, we have a little party after each show. And he goes, and she said, in Washington, when we do a show, we can't wait to get away from each other. and I said, that's so sad. So we have a little party every week, and then people go off for the weekend, and then we come back on Monday, and we make a new show Friday.
That's telling, because I think of the Sunday morning talk shows and what word discourse is. That seems to be pre-planned. Everything about it now is a stop on the campaign trail, or that's where the pundits are going to do their thing, and you kind of know what episode every episode is going to be like. On the other side, you have Real Time, and before that, Politically Incorrect, where it almost feels like when those shows are humming with the speed that you guys want them to be, it's when there's this sort of randomness, this authenticity, where there just seems to be kind of going off the rails a little bit.
And you mentioned Gore Vidal, and Bill and I are the two oldest people on the staff. So we remember Firing Line with William mm-hmm. F. Buckley.
That was great.
And Gore Vidal, Norman Mailer, these people who, when they would come on Dick Cavett or other shows, it felt so alive in a way that everything has kind of moved away from. And so we feel honored to be getting this last forum for it. And now we've been around so long that people really want to be on the show. I mean, there were times early on when, can we fill these chairs by showtime?
That's hard to believe.
Yeah. But that was true. And now we are very lucky to have just Bernie Sanders is going to be on the next show, which is the 27th. He was first on Politically Incorrect in November of 1993.
When you guys started Politically Incorrect, I mean, to think now, I mean, it's obviously different iterations and it's Real Time now, which are different. But the concept of having different people with different disciplines get together, mostly, you know, you'd have one, you know, politician, maybe one journalist, one comedian. I mean, trying to step away from it, did you think it would have this kind of longevity? I mean, what was your thought moving into it? Do you think that people were going to accept it the way they did?
Well, the original idea came out of conversations that Bill used to have in his own living room with friends of his from different disciplines. And then when we were developing it before the first day of taping, I remember just saying to him, at that point, I've been doing TV for about 5 years and thought that how many more years can I be doing television before I've got to go back to the clubs and do comedy? And I said, look, this is a very strong idea. And very often what happens, the closer that an idea gets to its first day of taping, the more networks will sort of pressure you to want to hedge your bet and dilute the boldness of the idea. But I said, look, here's my pledge is we're not going to dilute this. We're going to have, this is going to be the idea, and either it's going to work and it's going to be a big success, or it's going to completely fail, and it won't be the first television show that's failed. So let's have it right. be that. And so, you know, to his credit, I mean, he has always been a very firm believer in whatever ideas he has at that moment. He has complete conviction in them. There's never a time where he takes a stance on the show that he's just taking to be devil's advocate. Everything he says, he believes.
It's legitimate, yeah.
It's completely legitimate. And that makes it easy for,
right.
for the producers to be then booking people opposite him.
Right.
Because we know where he is.
I mean, one of the things I love about Real Time is the celebrity guests that will come on halfway through the show and be able to be the special guests on the show. A lot of them actors, a lot of comedians, a lot of people you wouldn't necessarily think are going to engage in this kind of conversation, a political conversation, religious conversation. What it might be a little more heady than whatever their movie is that's coming out on the next weekend. For you, finding those people is probably not that hard at this point because everyone wants to come on Real Time with Bill Maher. Is the job become making sure you have the right person who's going to have rapport, chemistry, and something to say?
Yes, because even though the mid-show interview is about 5 minutes, that can be a very long 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of actors and actresses who consider themselves to be political. And then when you find out what that means, it usually comes down to something like they don't like Trump or they hate George Bush or something. And it doesn't go much deeper than that. So we do a lot of work in both making sure that the people who come on can talk for 20, 25 minutes if they had to, that they have a depth of knowledge in what we're going to get them to do. The mid-show place has been a great spot for us in getting people who might not feel comfortable talking specifically about politics
right.
to come on to talk specifically about something that they care about.
Climate change, something like that.
A perfect example. So, you know, Mark Ruffalo is very well-versed in environmental causes, and he got this when he and his wife and family moved to upstate New York, and they started dealing with the results of fracking and what it was doing to their water supply and all this stuff. So he has actually testified in front of Congress. He's very well versed, really knows what he's talking about. I mean, there are a lot of people, Kerry Washington. I mean, there's just so many people who really know mm-hmm. issues that they care about, and then that mid-show format
right.
is a great place for them.
What's great about the show is echoed as well in the play is this heady conversation about ideas. We're not getting – this happens on Real Time all the time where it could easily go down into, you know, the he said, she said, and it tries to. Trust me, the panel is political one way or the other. But it does – Bill seems to move it up to a more heady idea about the future of our planet, the future of politics, so how are we going to live together. Religion plays a huge role. Is that – easier said than done?
Well, the other part of Bill's considerable talent is he's sort of a de facto, he's like a hedge fund manager for the conversation, that if it gets too in the weeds at some point, he makes a joke and brings it back up, and it's a counterbalance. And I would also say that, you know, after doing this for so long, he just has such a wealth of knowledge, and he's so clear on so many viewpoints. I just remember, I mean, he's off the air now, but when he would do Larry King, and he'd do an hour, and Larry King would just ask him a question at the beginning of each segment, and Bill would then talk for 7 or 8 minutes or whatever it was. They go to commercial, come back, ask him another question. And that if you came to our writers' meeting on a Tuesday, you would think it's a think tank that just happened to be populated by really funny people. That's what it is, but it's a room full of often brilliantly talented, really funny, witty people. But we're talking about the most serious
right.
issues that exist
Real
in
stuff,
the world.
Right. You're yeah. not writing a script. I mean, this
yeah.
is, you are trying to find the topics that people care about. Last question about Real Time. Because of Bill and his very well-known politics, I mean, it does come across as a liberal show, almost like a, on one hand, you have Bill O'Reilly, the other hand, you have Bill Maher. Are you guys comfortable with that? Are you comfortable in this day and age having a show that is unabashedly liberal, that is the yin to the yang of maybe a Fox News?
But we'll criticize liberals in a way. I mean, I feel like he, in a way, on Fox, Bill O'Reilly, because of his ratings, he's one of the few on Fox who can kind of take on conservatives. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Bill's a little bit like that as a mostly liberal. But we also take on Democrats a lot. And the other thing that is a testimony to his talent and his character is the willingness to have really strong people on who are completely the opposite from his viewpoint. And he believes enough in what his own convictions are that he will let them be tested by having strong opponents.
Right. As we wrap up here, I mean, we talked about your play being life's work in the way that you spent 29 years on the play. It was just, you know, hit L.A. last year. It's now in Chicago at the Northlight through June 12th. But, you know, that plus, you know, Bill Maher, which Real Time and Politically Incorrect. I mean, how many episodes? I mean, you combine the two together, you're talking 1,200 episodes of television. When you get done with a project like the play that you just spent 29 years on and you have a career of 1,200 episodes in the same, pretty much the same kind of show, what's next for you? I mean, do you feel like consistency is a big part of, like, you need a project to work on?
Well, first of all, I think that Real Time can keep going for a long, long time. As long as Bill wants to do the show, I think the network will let us keep the show. We're on through November right now. And so that could last for a long time. And then the play, I actually have a companion evening to Discord called Harmony.
Great.
And the basic premise of that is it takes place in a theater where Discord is being performed. And the three Brilliant. Characters yeah. are the three actors.
That's great.
And one of them thinks the other two have been doing it too long and they're getting tired and they're phoning it in. So he's called them to the dark theater on a dark afternoon to yell at them. And that's where the other play starts off.
Another 29 years on this one?
Well, no. I've already had. I finished a first draft last year. I've already had a couple of readings, and I do not have at this point in my life, I will not be able to do one play every 30 years. I've got to work a little bit faster.
Well, Scott Carter's play that's at the Northlight Theater is called "The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy." Discord. It's a hit. The Sun-Times and Tribune love it. It's on stage till June 12th. Carter is currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher, and we'll be looking for Harmony sometime soon. Scott, thanks for joining me at the big table.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.